Welcome to New Books in Biography. I'm Oline Eden. The birth control activist Margaret Sanger is among the most colorful and controversial figures of the 20th century. Her views on reproductive rights are often criticized by conservatives, and due to her socialist leanings and purported belief in eugenics, the liberals are equally reluctant to claim her. But biographers are terribly brave souls. In her new book, the renowned feminist historian Jean H. Baker provides a serious, nuanced, and fascinating portrayal of the activist. Today I'm going to be speaking with her about the book, Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion. Hi, Dr. Baker. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books in Biography today. I wonder if you could kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a native Marylander, and I live in Baltimore and have lived in Baltimore all of my life. I'm married and have four children, grandchildren. I've studied mostly in Maryland, and I have a PhD from Johns Hopkins, and I've written other books, increasingly in recent years, focused on women. But when I began, I was interested in Maryland and its allegiance during the Civil War, in part because Maryland's a divided state, and I discovered while I was in graduate school that my great-great-great-grandparents were, one fought up for the Union and one for the Confederacy. But in time, and I think this is partly because I teach at a liberal arts college and am not, to some extent, constrained by the specialties of graduate students, in time, in my research, I've been able to move into other fields from Maryland to American politics during the 19th century, and then to books on women's suffrage. And finally, this most recent book on Margaret Sanger, the great birth control pioneer.
Right, and it's a wonderful book. It's entitled Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion. What drew you to Margaret Sanger in particular? I know she's kind of a difficult figure. What was the allure there?
Yeah, she certainly is controversial. I like controversial women to write about. I have written a biography of Mary Todd Lincoln. I think mostly there probably are two reasons why I focused on Margaret Sanger. And the first is it seemed a natural progression from a book that I did entitled Sisters on the American Suffragists. And after the suffrage amendment was ratified in 1920, it seemed that the women's movement just disappeared. Alice Paul, the very courageous fighter for women's suffrage who began all of the picketing of Woodrow Wilson, she worked on the National Women's Party on the Equal Rights Amendment, but it got nowhere. But there was one reform, and I think it was the most successful one during this period, and that was Margaret Sanger and her effort to make birth control legal and accessible and cheap. So I began very tentatively at first to see what I could find out about Sanger. And then the second reason why I wrote this biography emerged, and that was that Sanger is really vilified unfairly today. She's used as this symbol of Nazism and eugenicism. Herman Cain, for example, referred to her, yes, that Herman Cain, several weeks ago, and said that she was a racist who had established birth control clinics to prevent black babies from being born. He called it planned genocide. And this is just crazy. Sanger was ahead of her time to some degree about the need for blacks as well as whites to have a birth control. And she certainly wasn't interested in planned genocide. So this effort by those who are interested in defunding Planned Parenthood became very absorbing to me, and I saw Sanger has really been historically misused by a certain part of the population, and that really encouraged me to get through the 170 reels of microfilm that represent the Sanger archive. So it's for these two reasons that I began this biography.
Since Sanger frequently explained her involvement in birth control by pointing back to her parents and her childhood, can you talk a bit about her early years?
Yes, and it's interesting. Sanger is not like most of the other reform women. They came from well-educated households, and they were mostly middle class. Elizabeth Cady Stanton's father was a judge. Lucy Stone's father was able to send her brothers to Bowdoin College. But Sanger comes from a very deprived background. She's the sixth of 11 children in a household in Corning, New York. It has a, I don't know whether you call it a mountain or a very, very big hill, but it rises abruptly from the Chemung River, and all the rich people lived at the top, and it was sort of gradated. The Higginses, and she was born Margaret Higgins, lived at the bottom, and her father was iconoclast in some ways. He was a sculptor of gravestones. He made these gorgeous stone roses to decorate the graves of the dead children in Corning, but he was constantly at war with the Catholic fathers who pretty much ruled Corning. And so Margaret Sanger grew up in this household with many, many, many children, with a mother who suffered from tuberculosis, and this father who was pretty much of an outsider in town. Sanger once wrote that her mother died at 48, but my father lived to be 80, and she didn't need to say anything more of this constant childbearing that her mother endured. And certainly that would be one of the motivations for her interest in birth control.
And how did she wind up meeting William Sanger when she got married?
Well, I think there's another chapter that we need to open the door to, and that is her. When Sanger went to school, she went to a parochial school, and she had a fight one day with a teacher. Unlike most of us, she refused to go back to school. And her sisters, one of whom was a domestic servant, in fact both were, somehow came up with the money to send her to a boarding school, Claverack and Hudson River Institute. And this, it seems to me, opened the door for Sanger to move into another world besides Corning, to get away from these limited opportunities that young women had during her period. Remember, she's born in 1879, so this is 1900, just in the 1890s, when she's beginning. She goes to Claverack, and she sees these opportunities, but she does not want to be a domestic servant. She does not want to be a factory worker in Corning. She does not, and this is the other opportunity, if it's that, that women had. She does not want to get married to one of the men in Corning, which is what her younger sister, Ethel, did. So she becomes a nurse, and that's a opportunity that was opening up for young women. It's typical of Sanger that she would seize this opportunity, and she went through a what we would call very rudimentary nursing training in White Plains, New York. And it's there one day that just by chance, She meets William Sanger, the architect who's come to discuss a building with one of her dancing partners. They were having a dance, apparently, at this nursing school. And he is absolutely smitten, as many, many men were with Margaret Sanger. She was a really appealing woman to both men and women, but especially to men, and he courted her. I'm not sure she wanted to get married. I think she hesitated for a while, but William Sanger was dramatically different. He was quite exotic. He was well-educated. He knew about socialist theory that her father had talked about in Corning, and so they were married in 1902, and so began what is really her most typical, in terms of middle-class life, her most typical years. She and Bill Sanger, they lived in Hastings-on-Hudson, where he had built a house. She had three children, and she did live this typical suburban life outside of New York. But, and here is one of those choices, and Sanger's always making what I would call contested choices, different choices that most women wouldn't have made. They move back into New York, and soon enough, Sanger is working for the Socialist Party, which her husband is a member of, and she's involved with these left-wing circles in New York, including the famous IWW Wobbly Union leader, Bill Haywood. She goes to Lawrence when there's a strike, and she also goes to Paterson, New Jersey. She's incorporated into this circle who introduced her to all kinds of different ideas.
I was intrigued because early on you characterized Sanger as, quote, an adroit fabulist, which is a really important character trait to identify in your subject. So how did this tendency of Sanger's affect the way that you approached her?
Yeah, it is a problem because she makes things up and exaggerates. The most famous and probably unimportant, unless you're a psychologist, example of this is that she begins taking her younger sister's age. And so she takes 5 years off of her birth year. So she says she's born in 1883 rather than 1879, and this is just absolutely not true. As a biographer, one of the problems is that for her early life, we're most dependent on what she tells us in these two books. One, My Fight for Birth Control. They're both very autobiographical, and the other is the autobiography of Margaret Sanger. So as a biographer, you have this woman who often makes up, exaggerates, etc. And yet the record that you have is mostly her discussion and presentation of her life. And so I think that you have to take into consideration what this tells you about Sanger, the woman, and the pioneer of the birth control movement. To me, what this suggests is that she was able to deal with an unpleasant reality. And it's not a question of denial so much as to be optimistic. I think all reformers, especially one in this terribly difficult area of birth control, which most people won't pay any attention to, they think it's salacious, etc., she had to be a fabulist about some aspects of her life, but she never was that way with the demands of the organizational movement. She was always realistic about what was going on in the American birth control movement. She was less less realistic and more of a fabulist in her personal life. And, of course, as we'll probably get into, her personal life involved many, many love affairs with a different man. And I think, for example, that's one reason why she took the years off of her life. She wanted to be young and vigorous. She said once that she never looked backward, she only looked forward. And because she believed that way, the optimism helped the birth control movement. You can't devote your whole life to a cause like birth control unless you're a visionary and looking forward. On the other hand, she wanted to have fun, and she certainly did, with these many, many men who adored her. And one of the interesting things about Sanger's personal life is that she would have affairs with men, and unlike most women, including her sometime adversary and rival, Emma Goldman, the men continued to love Margaret Sanger even when the sexual intimacies were over.
Can you tell us how she actually got directly involved in the birth control movement? Obviously, it wasn't called that at the time. But how did she begin to become active in that?
Mm-hmm. Sanger, by the way, named birth control so that she's not only present at the beginning, but she names it. There were all these, I would say, euphemisms for birth control. Voluntary parenthood, venereal prophylaxis, what the hell is that? But she came down with this notion that it should be called birth control one evening. The really important event that occurred in 1912 was the epiphany, or at least this is what she describes as the epiphany for her. She got a telephone call from a physician to come down to the Lower East Side. Sadie Sachs, a young woman with three children, had gone to an abortionist. And remember, abortion is illegal and therefore dangerous. It occurs in back alleys. And Sadie Sachs was hemorrhaging, so Sanger grabbed the little black bag, the emblem of nurses, and hastened to the apartment. And when the bleeding was stopped, Sanger heard Sadie Sachs say, "What can I do to prevent another child?" And the physician, in that indifferent way of physicians who oppose birth control, said, "Tell Jake to sleep on the roof." And a couple months later, Sayo was again called back to the Sachs apartment, and a raging infection in her vagina, and she was dead very soon. And this was, for Sanger, the event of the road to Damascus in which she saw the future. She writes very poignantly in her autobiography that when she came into her own apartment, she looked over the city and saw it sleeping and saw in her mind all these little babies that were born who couldn't be taken care of, who were cold, and the coffins, the coffins, the coffins, she writes. And in that context of that event, which may have been a compilation of several stories that she put together, that event was the beginning of her crusade for birth control. And from 1912, really up to the 1960s, when physically she was unable to do much, this is the ruling passion of her life.
I do think it's important to point out that Sanger herself did lose a child. She had a young daughter who died quite young, correct?
Yes. Sanger was an unusual mother. She left. She was indicted under the famous Comstock Law for some of the things she had written in her first magazine or pamphlet, or I'm not exactly what you would call it. It was The Woman Rebel, and she began it. And soon enough, the post office had confiscated some of the issues, and soon enough after that, Sanger was indicted for the violation of the Comstock Law. She decided to leave the children, and she left and went to England. And when she returned, a month later, this third child, Peggy, age five, was suffering from pneumonia and died in November of 1915. Her granddaughters, Sanger's granddaughters, have told me that, who knew her well in her later years, said that this was the greatest tragedy that Sanger ever endured. And as a result, Sanger became, to some extent, what I would call a spiritualist. She certainly was engaged with mediums. She had seances. She became a Rosicrucian. She was fascinated with the possibility of recalling spirits. And she was devastated, perhaps a little bit from guilt, because she had left Peggy, the daughter that died, and had been in England for a year before this.
You hit upon the Comstock Laws, which play a huge part in any discussion of early contraceptive history. Can you give us a quick overview of what those were exactly and how they related to Sanger and what she was trying to do? Because she really was trying to dismantle them, essentially.
Mm-hmm. The Comstock Law was passed in 1873, and it takes the name of Anthony Comstock, this mustachioed, a social purist who, as H.L. Mencken once said, I think worried that someone somewhere was having a good time. Comstock had grown up in Connecticut. He'd been in the Civil War, and he came to New York and was horrified by what he saw in New York in terms of pornography, etc. So he began this crusade to have a national legislation passed, and in 1873, he went to Congress. He took with him this collection of dildos and pornographic pictures, and he set it up, one can imagine trying to do this today, in the halls of Congress. Now, this is a Congress that was seen to adjourn in March of 1863, and Comstock's law, he lobbied the senators and representatives, and he made the case that birth control should be included in the definition of obscene matter. And so at the end of the session, Congress passed the Comstock Law, gave Comstock himself the authority to arrest people and take them before magistrates. The law said that any advertisement or sharing or marketing or distributing of birth control devices or apparatuses was illegal, and birth control was included under the definition of obscene and pornographic material. Now, for someone like Sanger, this is the barrier. You will never get doctors to become interested in prescribing prescribing birth control if it's illegal. You can never advertise. You can never have research. You can never have importation of devices from other countries. So Sanger's big campaign in the 1930s, this doesn't really happen until the 1930s, she set up first this idea of activism and then organization, and then eventually she gets to legislation. She goes to Congress to lobby for the repeal of the Comstock Act, and she is not successful. In fact, the Comstock Act is not repealed until the 1970s, but what does happen is that in the 1930s, the Supreme Court rules in a famous case, United States versus one Pessary, that the Comstock Law is an unnecessary restraint on individual freedom, and that Pessary's, what we call diaphragms, can indeed be imported. So Comstock's had a lot of enemies. The Roman Catholic Church, of course, is one, but the legal enemy is the pervasive power of the Comstock Law, which is replicated in many, many states. Many states, New York is one, have laws that are based on the Comstock Law. Now, in New York, Sanger's husband is arrested under the Comstock Law by Comstock himself. Comstock actually went around and set these sting operations up, and he would pose as a woman who needed some kind of advice, or in the case of Bill Sanger, he actually came to Sanger's apartment and said, "Do you have a copy of Family Limitation," which is one of Sanger's writings on birth control, and actually the best information on birth control for this period. And what would happen would be, finally, Bill Sanger found a copy, and then Comstock arrests him. So the issue of getting rid of the Comstock Law was one which Margaret Sanger confronted from the time she began the movement in 1912 until 1937, when the Supreme Court overturned many of its provisions.
What was the state of contraceptives during this time? What were what was available to people for them to use?
Contraceptives have been around forever. In Egypt, in 1600 BC, there are papyri that show that crocodile dung was used as a spermicide. Women would use it and rub it on little gauze or whatever, and then insert it in their vaginas. So for women, there were spermicides of various kinds. Not many women had access to crocodile dung, but other kinds of often folklore remedies that would be used. And there were douches. The main research area for many, many years was to try to find some sort of acidic spermicide that could be used. And Sanger, who was very alert to new research, She worked on this herself until she decided that hormones were the most exciting and important way to go. But besides this, of course, there were condoms, and condoms remained one of the most effective ways to prevent conception. The problem for Sanger was that she wanted to have a contraception that women controlled. And so she continued to work with the douches, the spermicides, and it was not until the 1930s that we begin to see the possibility of a hormonal anovulant that will be successful. But I think the major point here is that women have always tried to do something to control their fertility. And most of these contraceptives were not very effective, and this was a source of great frustration for Sanger.
What was the response to her early work? I know she had a series of pamphlets called What Every Girl Should Know, so she was really trying to inform people and give them as much information as she could, but it met with a lot of resistance legally, obviously. What was the response to her in the community?
Well, in her early community, she existed in this Greenwich Village progressive group along with the socialist community. I think one of the real important stages in her life is when she begins writing for the New York Call, which is a socialist, I can't remember whether it's a daily or a weekly. I guess it's a weekly. And she was convinced that no one knew anything about sex, which was true, and she wanted to be able to inform her children. The first writing that she did in the New York Call had to do with what every girl should know and what every boy should know, and when these were and what every mother should know, when these were published in the Call, they were confiscated, and there's a wonderful story about the Call then printed What Every Girl Should Know, and then had in large block letters nothing. And this was the way that Margaret Sanger thought that most of the conventional world thought about sex, and she was right about that. What had bothered the censors was the reference to venereal diseases, which today we would hardly, we would just be astonished that that would be the case, that discussion or mention of syphilis or gonorrhea would lead to censorship. But nonetheless, this is the way it was in New York in the from 1910 to about 1925. The other important writing that Sanger did during this early period is the pamphlet Family Limitation. And here she was very graphic in the descriptions and the illustrations that took that she used. And this Family Limitation went into 6 or 7 editions. It was an astonishingly successful and popular kind of writing, and she was at this stage of her life, she was very interested in the possibilities of educating women so that they would know more about their bodies. One of the things I remember about Family Limitation is it tells women to have a calendar and write down when their menstrual periods came. This, again, for us probably would not be startling news, but for Sanger and the women who lived in her time, it was new information, and she began getting all these letters from women. Dear birth control, some of them would read, please send me information about my body and how I can not have babies.
One of the interesting things that comes across in your portrait of her is that she does kind of emerge as a bohemian. I've always seen her as this fierce advocate and kind of a nurse and a harsh, somewhat medical figure. But she really seems like a lively, animated character in a bohemian sense.
Oh, yes. And I think this is what the the men enjoyed about her. She loved dancing. One of the stories about Greenwich Village is that she went, Mabel Dodge, later married to Tony Lewin, was a rich woman who had what I would call a salon on Fifth Avenue, and everyone would go there for these wonderful parties, and there would be discussions and about serious topics, about philosophers like Nietzsche, etc. Mabel Dodge once wrote in her autobiography that Sanger was the first person she'd ever met who talked about sex and made it a human experience, a universal experience that women could enjoy. And Mabel Dodge Lewin herself was certainly a bohemian, as you say, but she was astonished at how open Sanger was about sex and sexuality. I don't know exactly where this would come from. I think two sources. One, when she grew up in Corning, there would be little that she did not know in this tiny little house with all these children about childbirth and her mother and father's sex life. And the other thing is that she later thanked Bill Sanger for his help in this. I think Bill and Margaret Sanger had a very enlightened sex life. And so from this came the idea that women should have autonomy over their own bodies, and instead of hating sex, they should begin to enjoy it. And this was very much accepted, of course, by all these bohemians in Greenwich Village.
While we're here, would you like to discuss the lovers a little bit?
I couldn't hear.
While we're here, would you like to discuss the lovers a little bit?
Some other what? Other lovers?
Yes.
Oh. Sanger was never a beautiful woman, but she was, I guess we would say she had sex appeal. She had the Higgins nose, but she had this luxuriant, at first reddish hair that turned darker as she grew older. But there was something about her persona, and this attracted a multitude of men. She also, in the Greenwich Village society that she had adopted, there were many what we might call free lovers. There were couples who had affairs outside of marriage, and I think this influenced Sanger. She had her first affair in maybe 1912, 1913, and she asked her husband, Bill Sanger, he having earlier been the radical, whether he could adopt what we might call an open marriage. And he then turned very, very conservative and said, no, absolutely not. I love you. You were a world lover. And indeed she was. She had affairs with, I think, especially of interest, Englishmen, the famous sexologist Havelock Ellis, who had a tremendous influence on Margaret Sanger, and even H.G. Wells, some Englishmen whose names we have forgotten. And in the United States, she had long-term affairs with a number of men. She enjoyed this. This is why the subtitle of this book is A Passionate Life. She enjoyed sex. It was something that she intended to have and to explain to other women its importance in their lives. At the end of her life, she had an affair with two men. One was an artist from Pennsylvania State University, and the other was an architect who once wrote her that he had learned to fly an airplane because he wanted to be able to come and see her more often. But the problem with having a love affair with Margaret Sanger is that always it was secondary to what she was doing for birth control, and this irritated some of these men. Others, not so much. Hobson Pittman, who was one of the artists who was one of her lovers at the end of her life, once told her that he didn't want to drive across the country with her because his reputation might be sullied. And Sanger's reaction to this was just fury. She had been driving across the country with many, many men, and she was astonished that this man would even worry about that. The interesting thing about her time period, of course, is that she never, never wanted anybody to know about the affairs, but no one picked up on this. This was never used by her opponents against birth control. Instead, her personal life was left, for the most part, out of things, even though in 1920 she's divorced from Bill Sanger. In 1922, she marries her second husband with the stipulation that they're going to lead separate sexual lives. He, of course, is just overwhelmed with passion for Margaret Sanger and is 20 years older also. But she, on the other hand, led an independent sexual life even after her marriage to J. Noah Slee.
In the early 1920s, Sanger published two books on eugenics, which are often seen as sort of the darker side of the birth control movement. Can you discuss Sanger's views on eugenics and also put them in historical context for us?
I don't think I'd characterize both books as on eugenics. The New Race and The Pivot of Civilization are really, to me, feminist explanations of what birth control will do. Now, in terms of general eugenicism, this is the thing that has made Sanger so controversial during the ages and still to some extent contaminates her reputation. I want to say a couple of things about that. The first is, and this is by no means to absolve her of her eugenicism, but the first thing is that the entire United States was awash with eugenicism during this period. There were very few Americans who were not eugenicists. You would go to a country fair and play a game, and the game would be that the light would light up when a fit child, fit, so to speak, in quotation marks, was born. And this, of course, took much, much longer than the lights that lit up when unfit children were born. American presidents, from Teddy Roosevelt through to William Howard Taft, through to Woodrow Wilson, supported the idea of using biology to have better Americans. And that's what eugenics means. You, meaning good, and genes, good genes. So I think that you've got to put Margaret Sanger, first of all, in the context of an America where the Supreme Court in 1927, in a landmark case, Buck v. Bell, rules, and these are the words of Oliver Wendell Holmes, that three generations of imbeciles are enough, and so, therefore, it's okay to sterilize, involuntarily carry a buck. Now, Sanger goes along with eugenics at first, I believe, to gain support and respectability to the birth control movement. These are very famous scientists who are eugenicists. They include Henry Goddard, Paul Papineau, Raymond Pearl. Almost any scientist that you can name supports the idea of eugenicism. So she encourages these men to support birth control. But the second thing I would say, as she became more and more associated with eugenics, she's not a very good one. First of all, Sanger is not a believer in the basic credo, more children from the fit, that is the good people who have good genes, and fewer from the unfit. She never goes along with that particular philosophy. Moreover, she's an environmentalist. Sanger had been around the Lower East Side and Corning too long to not believe that if you changed the external conditions that human beings, Americans, lived in, that their lives and also their children would be better. She is what I would call a feminist eugenicist. She believed that if she could just get birth control and get women to use birth control, they would space their babies, and that's a eugenics proposition. The mothers would take better care of them. The families would have more money. And so birth control became her answer to this idea of biology creating better humans. Now, it is true that by the 1930s, she supports involuntary sterilization, never for a group of people, but for those who are mentally ill. But she does not believe in surgical castration, which would eliminate their sexual urges. She simply believes in vasectomies or salpindectomies, tying the tubes of women. So while Sanger is a eugenicist, she certainly is a different kind of eugenicism, but most particularly, she needs to be put in the context of a society in which all opinion makers support various forms of eugenicism.
I think it's also important to establish this is a context where birth control was still not really seen as a medical issue, correct? That the American Medical Association had not really come out to support it?
The doctors were less than enthusiastic about birth control, I think for a couple of reasons. I think that if had Sanger been able to get their support, things would have moved much more quickly. Doctors represented higher socioeconomic groups, conservatives, and so they did not support birth control. They thought, many of them thought, that Sanger was just an hysterical propagandist. And others, Howard Kelly is the example here, actually, and he's a gynecologist, a very famous gynecologist of this period, he believes that if you use birth control, it caused cancer. I'm not sure which forms of birth control he was referring to, but there was this general sense by physicians that they didn't want to have anything to do with it. Now, if you want to be cynical, you could certainly say that for some of these doctors, birth control violated their efforts to establish a profession. Many of them were obstetricians. Obstetrics was a fairly new discipline, and so you needed work. So you certainly didn't want to have support this idea of controlling fertility. You wanted to have as many babies born as possible. It was not then until 1937 that the American Medical Association came out and passed a resolution supporting birth control, and did so only after the Supreme Court decision, the United States versus One Pessary, which essentially struck down the Comstock Law. There were some exceptions to this, a few. The most outstanding is Robert Dickinson, who sparred with Sanger about her clinics, but the two finally came to respect each other. But Sanger, you see, is if you think about this, here's this woman, and she started this organization, and she has support from some of the wealthy people in New York, and she set up a nationwide organization, but she has no powerful supporters to help her, not the medical profession, not at this stage nearly all religions, although that will change in 1930, and so some of the decisions and tactics that Sanger used, I think, are perfectly explicable given the context in which she worked.
You mentioned U.S. versus One Package. Can you talk about that a bit more?
Yeah. Well, Sanger orchestrated. I mean, this is why I admire this woman so much. She orchestrated that case. She had been to Japan by this time, and there was this new pessary, a diaphragm, and she always thought that diaphragms were the most effective birth control for women before, of course, the pill. And so she had encouraged this Japanese gynecologist to mail her some pessaries. They were confiscated by the United States Postal Service, and her lawyer, a very famous civil liberties union lawyer, Morris Ernst, told her that she would have no standing because she was not a doctor, and the best way to do this is to have the diaphragms, the pessaries, mailed to Hannah Stone, Dr. Hannah Stone, who at the time was in charge of the Margaret Sanger Research Bureau. So the pessaries arrive, and they're confiscated, and so Stone goes to court and sues, and the case gets to the New York Supreme Court. I'm sorry, it gets to the District Court, and then the United States Appeals Court, and the court rules in favor of the birth control advocates on the basis that things have changed. What a previous court might have ruled by progress and understanding about sex. This was a case that was not dependent on what we would naturally think today would be the basis of the 14th Amendment, or the First Amendment. So Sanger wins this case, the appeal, and this is the real landmark for the overturning of the Comstock Law. Now doctors can send information to each other about birth control. Now foreign researchers can mail to the United States these changes in the diaphragm. But what's interesting about the particular kinds of instruments or the research is that all these people up until maybe 1935 are working within the same paradigm. They're trying to improve pessaries and diaphragms. They're trying to improve spermicides. And so, to some extent, the technology of birth control does not change even when the legal prohibitions are overturned.
Speaking of changes in technology, the creation of the pill. Can you discuss Sanger's role in that?
Again, this to me was just an outstanding example of the primacy of this woman. I'm not a great believer in the great men and women theories that they actually shape things, but in Sanger's case, it does seem to me that she shaped the birth control movement almost by herself. So by the 1930s, she's smart enough to have figured out, because again, she's organizing these conferences and sending to all kinds of scientists invitations to give papers. She's aware of the research that is going on in endocrinology, and she's aware of the possibilities of hormonal research. As early as 1931, she's talking about it. So in the period after World War II, there's more and more research that's being done, and Sanger is looking at a series of different kinds of approaches. And as I say, she hears about them in her conferences. These are worldwide conferences with the great names of endocrinology included. And she makes the decision that it's going to be an anovulant, that she has sufficiently understood this complex process where the pituitary gland sends follicle-stimulating hormones, and eventually the corpus luteum opens up and an egg comes out, and after that, the corpus luteum sends out progesterone, and it's progesterone that makes the lining of the uterus hospitable for the egg, but also, and this is the key point for that Sanger saw, prevents any more eggs from maturing. So that seemed to be, for Sanger, the answer, and she sees this. Even though for years she's been humiliated as a woman that didn't know anything about science, she goes to her very, very, very wealthy friend, Catherine McCormick of the McCormick Harvester fortune, and these two women together drive in this wonderful episode in 1953. They drive to Worcester, Massachusetts, to the lab of Dr. Gregory Pincus. And Pincus has been working on mammalian eggs for many, many years, probably knows more about the process of mammalian eggs and human eggs than anyone else in the world. He is, however, an outlier. He hasn't gotten tenure at Harvard, and he's had to set up this lab in Worcester, Mass. And he's dependent on pharmaceutical grants and individual grants. He's just lost a grant from Searle Company, the Swiss pharmaceutical company, and he entertains these two women in his lab, and at the end of their tour of the lab, Catherine McCormick says, I'm going to support your work. Here's $10,000, and I want to talk to my money man, and you will get some more. And over her lifetime, I think she gave millions of dollars and left more money to him in his will. Now, surely Sanger's commitment to Pincus's work, her ability to persuade McCormick that this was the way to go, stands as another of her triumphs in terms of her commitment to birth control. These two women pressed it at Pincus to hurry up. And Pincus, of course, is a good laboratory man, needed to be able to test the drug. There's been some criticism of the process of testing. In terms of the FDA and what was required for informed consent and all those things that we think of today, the process was probably as far advanced as any other at the time. And so during that 1950s, there are tests that are done in Puerto Rico, in Haiti, in Dr. John Rock's lab in Massachusetts, and eventually, again, Sanger and McCormick both pressing for a pill that can be ingested with, and the problem here is to get enough progesterone in the pill, and this was finally accomplished, and the FDA at first approved it just for infertility, which was sort of a joke. And finally, in 1962, in the form of Inovid, the pill became commercially available. And here, it seems to me, is the end of Sanger's quest for a contraceptive that's legal. She's been able to overturn the Comstock law that's easy and that you can take it by mouth, that's relatively cheap, and that is very, very effective. And in all those capacities, she has been the primary formulator and shaper of what happens.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today about Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion. Any idea who you'll be writing about next?
I'm going to, not yet. Under advisement. But it's nice to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
I've been speaking today with feminist historian Jean H. Baker about her latest book entitled Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion, which is now out in hardback. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books in Biography. Thanks for listening.